Thanks very much for joining me. I'm Bob Franklin. This is the Radio Public Affairs program, Like It Is. Today, Gene Moore interviews Julia Wright, the daughter of famed writer Richard Wright.
I'm Gene Moore, bringing you a very special on-site conversation with Miss Julia Wright, the daughter of internationally famous author Richard Wright, whose life became a seminal part of all that she has become and is. You have made Paris your home, or has it been your home all the time since you were born?
When my father and my mother left in self-proclaimed exile in 1947 to settle in post-war Paris, they took me with them. I was their kid. And my daughter was born on French soil. I lived my whole life, childhood, in France, went to French schools. Then when my father died, I went to Africa and worked in three West African countries. We can come back to that if you wish. Then lived for about 10 years in London, and then returned to Paris, which became my stable, permanent home, where my father was cremated and buried, and therefore the epicenter of my spiritual and political existence.
You say they went there in exile, their self-exile.
Yes.
Why was that?
I think that's multi-layered. I think perhaps the writers of the life of my father would like to simplify and stereotype this departure. Some say it was flight, like in Native Son, one of the sections is called flight. I think it's very multi-layered, like every choice in our lives. I think first and foremost, my father was concerned with creativity. Creativity being his reason for remaining alive, survival. His reason for self-respect. His reason for standing up and looking the others in the eye and saying, I am Richard Wright and I'm doing what I chose to do. Right.
There is some background now in terms of race and race relations. Was there anything involved in the exile that involved race and your mother?
Yes, but more, I think they could negotiate the couple relationship. I don't think they were afraid of that. It was more the fear for the children to be born. When my mother came back from the hospital to the white Italian, a white Italian section of Brooklyn back then, there was on the door a graffiti saying, the baby you are bringing home is fated for tar and feathers. My father, having an almost maternal instinct for his children, which is extraordinary and which none of the biographies have gone into, but which I have experienced firsthand, was furious. He would get biggerish whenever there was something that would hurt or harm our own creativity, as if he was reliving everything that had been done to maim his creativity in our own lives, the lives of his children. So it was less the interracial marriage than refusal to see us, the children, suffer.
In any event, it was home for him.
It became home for him. There were other reasons. He had just left the Communist Party, so he had two sets of harassments to deal with. The FBI wanting him to name names, thinking that having left the Communist Party, he would be willing to, little knowing my father, and the Communist Party harassing him to come back, you know, using power tactics, et cetera, et cetera. And he was being doubly watched, and all these reasons put together, and a final spiritual reason, which I will go into one day, and which I might actually be integrating in my soon-to-be-published biography, memoir biography, whatever the academics want to call it, is that I am convinced that we come from runaway stock. Rebel runaway stock, the Cimarron.
Talk about what you mean by that.
Well, it's very clear in the islands in the Caribbean that the runaways were considered by the plantation, quote, niggers, unquote, were rebels. They would not accept slavery. They would run away into the mountains. They would run away and they would lead an existence of their own, some of them forming pacts with the indigenous peoples, as the Seminole. I just have a gut instinct that if you run a thread through all my father's writings, but also through his life, his way of moving, being constantly on the move, is something which he is unconsciously repeating from the arrival into America as a slave and from memories unconsciously inherited from the ancestors.
Now, he was born in 1908, and he was born in a state known for not being the most liberal, the state of Mississippi. And has had some background as far as some of the kinds of things that may have happened to his own father. What was that like, and how did that affect him?
I think that my father was always standing apart. And I think that is what saved him. He watched his family at a distance. He watched the sectarianism of the Seventh-day Adventist streak in the women in his family, and he was able not to be influenced by that, but rather to regard it as something extraordinary and surreal. And that surrealism comes through in a beautiful essay that has not been published yet, but I wish I would like to see published during the centennial, Memories of My Grandmother, where he examines his grandmother's fanaticism in religion, and he forgives her, which is beautiful, and he talks about the whole concept of invisibility in religion, how his grandmother lived not, she lived in the world, but not of the world. Her eyes were always gazing at something else that was invisible, that made her invisible, and that made her not see the search for love in her grandchild. It is a beautiful text where he speaks about French surrealism. I believe he quotes Cocteau. There is an understanding from within of what surrealism can mean, and there is a deep understanding of his grandmother. And I would like to say that having come from the conference at Temple, some of the things that are still said about his hatred of the women and his family must be perhaps slightly altered and researched more deeply, and again, multi-layered, that this insistence that he hated his mother cannot bear a deeper glance that the psychiatrists whom my father read, be it Freud, Anna Freud the daughter, Ernest Jones, Grodek, the father of psychosomatism, and many others, say that real hatred stems from deep love, and the opposite of love is not hatred, but indifference. And my father was never indifferent to his mother.
He certainly was not indifferent to some of the things that he wrote about. Mm-hmm. We must mention that this is coming up on the centennial,
yes.
And that's one reason that you're here.
Yes.
And that in celebrating that centennial, I think you're also trying to make sure you're setting things right so that people will understand a lot more about him. Now, his book, for which he's most known, of course, mm-hmm. is?
Well, the two bestsellers are Black Boy and Native Son. And Bigger is still on many people's minds. In fact, Sonia Sanchez was suggesting that Bigger be adopted in the schools here in Philadelphia as curriculum, and I can only agree 300%. Now, I wanted to give some presents to my father for the centennial. So I am giving him a beautiful present. I know he's smiling. The three books that they allowed to go out of print because he was supposed to be punished for leaving the United States and writing from outside and writing politically and writing critically of the United States. Those three books are Black Power, Color Curtain, which is a description of the Conference of Bandung and the concept of non-alignment, and White Man Listen, which is a series of essays. Those books had been allowed, encouraged, in fact, to go out of print. We must punish the runaway, n'est-ce pas? Yes. So I thought, okay, we're going to turn these things around, and we're going to give Richard Wright a gift and give his readers and aficionados a beautiful gift for the centennial. We're going to reissue that in a trilogy, a paperback trilogy that the students can afford to buy and the professors can set as curriculum, even the teachers in the high schools. And it's happening. It's going to be out in February. That's the first gift. The second gift is I wanted something unpublished. I want to flesh him out. I want people to be able to reach down into his psyche. And I wanted people to read the last thing he wrote before he died, which is so interesting because it's a draft and it's an unfinished draft. It's stops at page 306, and there's no page 307 because he dies. It's unsubmitted because it's a first draft, and when I submitted it a year ago, it was rejected because, what can we do with this? They said. This is poor grammar, spelling mistakes, and only a first draft and unfinished. And I wrote a 7-page letter back saying, what? You are not concerned with what one of our greatest authors was thinking as he lay dying? What have we come to? And a few weeks passed, and I got the phone call. We will publish it, and you use that letter as the basis for the introduction to the book. That is happening on the 8th of January, A Father's Law, Richard Wright's last draft is coming out. And the subject is incredible. In 1960, only two American writers, greatest writers of American literature, had written about serial killing, Truman Capote and Richard Wright. I will only give you the theme and not spoil the suspense because it's his second attempt at a thriller. It's a black police commissioner who is promoted at the beginning of the draft to chief of police of a suburb, a white suburb, a rich suburb of Chicago, where a series of serial killings has taken place because they need a scapegoat in case the killer is not found. And what is better than a black scapegoat? So he is promoted to find the killer when nobody else has been able to find that killer. And slowly, slowly, he suspects over the pages that that killer might be his son.
Let's talk a bit now, though, about what the daughter, Julia Wright, is like and what has been happening to you and some of the things that were painful to you as a child and some of the things that you're involved in now as a very strong activist.
Well, you're right. You're a very, very sensitive interviewer. There are threads linking my childhood to what I am today. And that's what I told the professors yesterday at Temple and Penn. While I'm here, use me. I'm a very primary source. I was there in his houses. I know what he lived through. I am scarred by what he lived through. And what I live today is marked by what he lived through. He lived through McCarthyism. He lived through surveillance. He always wrote about what he did, and he always did things that were related to what he wrote about. So, an example, which was discussed yesterday, but in very academic terms. When he'd finished Native Son, he got interested in death rows throughout the country because he leaves Bigger to die on death row, and that is hard to be the author of a book and you leave your hero to die on the electric chair. He wasn't comfortable with that. And he began a correspondence with several death row prisoners and ended up by having a very prolific correspondence with a lifer called Clinton Brewer, and thought that he was so gifted as a musician that perhaps his creativity could save him from his murderous inclinations. So he took Clinton Brewer under his wing. He went to the governor of the state where the prison was, and he said to the governor, "Would you let me have Clinton Brewer as a protege? I will take him back to the house, and I will be responsible for him." And the governor said, "Mr. Wright, how can I say no to you?" And so he brought Clinton Brewer back to the house, and my mother was pregnant with me. That was late 1941. So here I am today, an abolitionist. How could I not be?
Talk about you today.
Well, I've visited Mumia Abu-Jamal, who's been on death row for 25 years, about 20 times during the last 12 years. That's one thing. I went to meet President Kwame Nkrumah in late 1962 and worked there until the coup d'etat, and he was thrown over and we were arrested for having worked for him as a follow-up to my father's friendship with him and to my father's belief in Pan-Africanism. And my husband and I furthered those Pan-African objectives by interviewing, and I became a journalist, learning things as I went along, interviewing, and that was so extraordinarily exciting. The liberation movements, the freedom fighters against colonialism, who had been offered unofficial embassies in Accra, by Kwame Nkrumah. I met these men who were killed, like Amilcar Cabral of Guinea-Bissau, killed. I met the leader of Frelimo, that was Mozambique. I met Agostino Neto. I met Mario de Andrade, who had a great friendship with my father, who was a poet. I met these wonderful freedom fighters who believed in the independence of their country and who gave up their lives for their African countries to be independent from Western colonialism.
Say something, though, about you as a child. You gave a little story at the conference yesterday about what you had to endure as far as your race in terms of your color and how that affected some events in your life.
Well, you know, I was thinking about that since yesterday, and you're going to get a little scoop here. There was an incident, a racial incident, with me as a child in the department store called Bergdorf Goodman, where Connie, one of my father's friends, took me one afternoon to allow my father some peace and quiet to write. And there was no trouble until the time I asked if I could go to the restroom. Well, you know, a little girl doesn't say restroom. I just said, I want to pee. And Connie had approached the counter, and only Connie was visible. And she was told, yeah, the restroom is over there. But when Connie went away from the counter, I became visible. And the sales girl called her back and said, oh, no, 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 no. Not the child, you. So I was told to be a good little girl and go and pee on the sidewalk. Well, strangely enough, as fate would have it, when we were arrested, my husband, my little girl of 2 years old, and myself, after the coup d'etat in Ghana, with the bayonets of Utsis in our stabbing our backs, and only the clothes we had on our backs, all our possessions left behind, and taken to the tarmac by Ghanaian soldiers who were high, because otherwise they couldn't have done it. My little girl said, Mommy, can I pee? She was in my arms. We were on the tarmac. We were under arrest. How were we going to manage this incident? And so I told the soldiers. No, first I told my husband. Then my husband told the soldiers. Then the soldiers conferred for a long time, and I was afraid there was going to be an accident. And I whispered to my child to be patient. And they finally said, she's allowed to do it if she moves 10 feet away. So I put her down. My little girl removed herself until she was told to stop. And they all trained their bayonets away from my husband and I on her while she urinated on the tarmac.
What will she remember of this as she gets older?
You see, I can't speak for her. All I can tell her is there is a thread in the family.
You know what you remember and what that did to you, though.
Exactly. And I am writing my memoir. Biography, memoir, whatever the academics choose to call it, for my children, so that they have the key to the kind of mother I was to them, and also the kind of grandmother I am to my grandchildren, who, when they perch on my knee and ask me for fairy stories, I tell them, because I love fairy stories. I was brought up on them. I know them all by heart. I love them. But I also tell them the story of Mumia Abu-Jamal. And they go to school, French school, and they say to their teacher, do you know who Mumia is? You know, in their little French accent. And the teacher says, no. And they say, we are going to tell you the story. And they teach the teacher.
You had a grandmother that was not that pleasant, though. No. Tell me about her.
Well, you see, our generations are so truncated that many of us don't know our grandmothers. I knew my maternal grandmother, and she used to want to wash my hair when she was babysitting me. And I suppose she thought her daughter had married a dark man, and unfortunately the child could have been lighter skinned. It would have been better for her. So when she washed my hair, she would yank the hair so violently, thinking she was going to straighten it. She was illiterate. That I know because my mother told me, and told me how she would teach her mother to recognize the names of the streets on the New York underground subway. I was in pain every time I knew that I would have as a babysitter my maternal grandmother, and I would go through that hair yanking.
And yet she was a person who had some repression against her as a Jewish person?
Exactly. And that is fascinating because if you want to generalize, and I don't like generalizing, but if you try to generalize a little bit, you'll find that when you've gone through intense repression, you can go two ways. You can go the way of rebellion and later in life, help other people in the spirit of what you have suffered, and you don't want to allow other people to suffer what you've suffered. Or you can go the conservative way of making other people suffer.
Special thanks to Jean Moore for her featured interview with Julia Wright. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.